I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of Shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
And hello to everybody out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network. I'm your host, Brandon Davis, with Front Row Classics, and we are rolling into 2020, just rolling right along, and 2021. I felt like we were still in 2020.
No, don't do that. We don't want any more 2020.
No. We've rolled into 2021, and we are here, and we have got a jam-packed year, and we're here to close out January in style, and I've got my co-host here with me, and it's Eric Flick. How's it going, Eric?
It's going really well, Brandon. How about with you?
Not bad, not bad. Hard to believe. I mean, we're almost through with January. It's crazy.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of, the holidays just kind of flew by, and, you know, a lot been going on out there, but this year's already begun, and almost a 12th of the way through.
Yeah, the holidays flew by and I had nothing to do over the holiday, which is crazy. It flew by faster than if I would have had something to do. But this is a special episode for us. If you're listening, of course, you subscribe to our feed because this is a feed-only episode. But we're tackling our first ever silent movie. And I can't think of anything better to start with than a movie by Charlie Chaplin, an artist who is still... who is still impacting our culture over a century later. And this movie, as a matter of fact, that we're talking about, City Lights from 1931, turns 90 years old January 30th. So we are just in time celebrating the anniversary and 90 years old, and we'll get into it, but dare I say, I don't think it's aged. I think it's still a beautiful film. It still does what he intended to do 90 years ago. And Eric, before we get into first impressions, do you just want to give a plot summary about City Lights?
Yeah, I'll give you a brief overview of this one. So this film, like a lot of Charlie Chaplin films, has a character that he created early on in the silent film career. So it's the recognizable character of the tramp or the little tramp. And we open up with the dedication of a statue in this sort of any town. And I'm going to assume it's the USA, but you could also say that this would have been, you know, early 1930s Europe as well. But there's a dedication of a statue going on. The statue is covered by a tarp and they pull it up and there's the little tramp character asleep in the arms of the statue. The people dedicating the statue yell at him to get down from there. And there's a several minutes long comedy scene of Charlie Chaplin getting out of the statue. And then he proceeds to kind of wander around the city because the tramp is obviously down on his luck. He's got tattered clothing observes a window where some art is being displayed, gets picked on by a couple of newsies for a little bit, and then stumbles upon a flower seller. Love at first sight. So our little tramp has a love interest, buys a flower from her, and in a case of mistaken identity, she thinks that he is a wealthy individual. So they kind of part ways there. Our next scene is the tramp looking for a place just to sit down. And there's a gentleman who's obviously drunk and intoxicated and is attempting to end his life by jumping into a body of water, a bay or something like that, and by tying a rock to it. Comedy again ensues and both the tramp and the other individual end up in the water. We find out that this guy is a millionaire. He takes the tramp back to his very large, very elaborately decorated house where he again tries to commit suicide. There's some dark things going on in this movie, but they eventually he gets talked out of that by the tramp. They go out on the town and to a dance hall, back to the house the next morning. The millionaire wakes up and has no recollection of the evening or even meeting this other individual. So he kicks the tramp out. The tramp leaves the millionaire's home, runs into the flower girl again, and correct me if I get the order mixed up here, Brandon, but he then finds out that there's an illness going on or something like that. He wants to make some money, so he goes and takes a job as a street sweeper. Goes to meet her during lunch, where he's procured groceries for her by using some of the salary that he makes as a street sweeper, but comes back and he's late back from his lunch. He's late too many times, so he gets fired from that job. So he needs to make some money fast, and he decides that he's going to take on a boxer, and he agrees to split the money with the boxer. They're both going to kind of take it easy on each other, but the boxer that he's scheduled to fight is going to be arrested by the police. So he takes off, and an actual boxer comes in, where it's a winner take all bout. The tramp loses that. He bumps in and get to the millionaire again, who's now intoxicated again, and says, "My friend," immediately recognizes the tramp again. So these guys get into a couple of other situations. The tramp ends up going back to visit his flower girl and is reading her the newspaper, and says that there's a doctor in there in Vienna who could fix her eyesight. And so he agrees to find a way to get the money for her. Goes back to find the millionaire who's intoxicated for the third time. And the millionaire agrees to give him $1,000, and unfortunately doesn't realize that there's robbers at the house, and gets knocked in the head, again forgets who Charlie Chaplin characters it is. So Charlie Chaplin takes off, even though the police have showed up to capture the robbers, with $1,000 in his pocket, gives it all to the flower girl and says, "I gotta go away for a while." Next day, he's arrested. So he goes away for a few months. So we move ahead in time for several months. When he gets out of jail, he's even more down and out, even shabbier. The same newsboys are picking on him again in front of where the flower shop girl, who's now cited, is running her own sort of upscale flower shop. And then finally, in the final scene of the movie, she finally realizes that this down and out person is her true love, who she thought was a wealthy millionaire, but was really just this tramp that they fell in love. And a very sweet scene at the end where they realize that they love each other. So kind of a long and convoluted plot, now that I think about it, for a 87-minute movie. It's got a lot of twists and turns.
It is. Let's just start with, this is going to be formatted probably a little bit different than our usual episodes, because a silent movie is a different animal than what we usually talk about. There's there's plenty of scenes and set pieces on this movie, but of course it's all pantomime and it's totally Chaplin's show. I mean, you've got some wonderful little supporting characters in this movie, and especially the flower girl, which we'll get into. But I just want to start off with, I know this is the first time you've actually seen this. What were your first impressions, and had you seen any of Chaplin's films before?
So just bits and pieces. You know, Charlie Chaplin, though, is, and this character is iconic. And probably my first impression of seeing this character was growing up in the 70s and 80s on Sesame Street. They used to parody the Charlie Chaplin character, and same little mustache, bowler hat, tight jacket, baggy pants, overly sized shoes, waddling walk. And so that character was being parodied even then, you know, some 65, 70 years later. And then I would catch bits and pieces of those movies. I don't know that I've sat down and watched a Charlie Chaplin movie start to finish like this one previously. say what you will about the time that we live in and the state of movies. But one of the good things right now that's going on in the world is you can get this movie and other silent films through streaming services. You don't have to go anywhere to get this, to get access to this movie. 10 years ago, I'm not sure that that was the case. You know, you had to go order a DVD. 20 years ago, it would have been even harder to find because you would have had to go find a tape of it somewhere. So we're fortunate that we can watch some of these movies that we probably wouldn't have had access to in years previous. So my first impression of this, though, it's a good movie. It doesn't need the dialogue. There's a certain attention that's paid to the physicality of each of the characters that you don't get in a lot of other movies too. And we'll talk about how we think this influences some of the other movies that we've even discussed in the past and some of the actors that we've discussed. The story's very clear, though. You don't need to understand any bit of dialogue. And there's very few title cards too. It's not like the silent movies that you think of with the mustache twirling villain and the damsel tied to the train tracks. And every 2 seconds there's dialogue up on the screen that you have to read. You get the impression of what's going on so strongly that you don't need anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the word genius is used a lot, I feel like, lately and I won't mention names, but people who don't deserve that title. But Charlie Chaplin was a genius. And I think, I forget who it was. I think it was Albert Einstein who actually accompanied him to the premiere of this movie. But of course, we're in 1931, so the medium was young. But he said, Charlie Chaplin is the only true genius to come out of the motion picture industry. And it's true, because if you watch other silent movies from that period, you're right, there's a lot of title cards, a lot of dialogue cards. And this movie, it's mostly just setting up the time of day. There's not mm-hmm. very much dialogue, and you could watch this movie without any of those cards and know what was going on.
Sure.
That's how brilliantly it's played. But I think the tramp character that Charlie Chaplin created, it's one of the most perfect like creations of any character, because he represents humanity and all of its flaws. And, you know, he represents the humor, he represents the poignancy. And City Lights is kind of the beginning of a trend, because before that, most of Chaplin's films were pretty much straightforward slapstick comedies. He starts to get a little more political. And this will go through, you know, Modern Times and The Great Dictator and other movies that would come along. And he really starts to mix comedy with poignancy and with a tinge of sadness, and it's permeated throughout this movie. But what he does so well is he walks such a brilliant line between humor and tragedy, because every time something, you know, comes along that you thought, oh, that can be really depressing, he throws in just a gut punch laugh mm-hmm. that is absolutely perfect. And there are so many moments in this movie that I just sit back and I think, now why does that just seem so perfect? And it's because, well, first of all, he was, you know, very well rehearsed, and second of all, he just knew how to tell a story through pantomime. And this movie was made in 1931. We're 4 years into talking movies, and Chaplin, you know, through his own opinion, and I'm a lover of dialogue and wonderful text and everything, but he thought that dialogue was unneeded in the motion picture medium. And so, and you'll notice in this movie, there's little jabs at dialogue, and because this isn't a full silent movie. He uses sound effects, and he uses other things. It's not just a score, which, by the way, he, I don't know if we even mentioned, but he directed this movie. He directed all of his movies and wrote them. And this is the first movie he composed the score to as well. So this is totally a Chaplin production. But yeah, I think Modern Times, I think, is my personal favorite of his movies, but I think City Lights is the greatest representation of what he can do. And there's so much going on, as you mentioned, in this, 87 minutes.
Yeah. And so not only did he think that the talkies were sort of unnecessary, I think he sort of famously predicted that they were going to fail, mm-hmm. that there was going to be, this will be a trend for a little while, and then people will go back to the silent movie, which is just, a little bit of, he put himself out there to make that statement. But he had been doing this since, I'm not sure when his first one was, but it was the early 1910s.
1914, I believe.
Yeah, so he had been doing this now for, 16, 17 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. And dozens of movies by the time that he got to this one. And I think you said it best when he is a storyteller, and he's a very visual storyteller. So not only does the story look very good when you look at the cinematography, where the camera is at any given moment, but then you got the choreography of how this movie moves too. And there are scenes that we'll get to that are just amazing. And when you realize that you're watching them and they're very, very well rehearsed, because there's no cuts. I mean, he takes some of these scenes and the amount of movement that are in them. It's just truly amazing that he conceived all of that in his mind and then wrote it out, directed it, how it was going to be shot. Filmed himself doing it, and then scored the thing too. I mean, he was a genius because of how eclectic he was, and he could do all of those things and do them very, very well. And I think you're right. This movie shows it probably more than some of his others would have.
Mm-hmm. And, this movie comes out in 31, but they started filming 2 years earlier in 29. It took about 2 years to make this movie. And it actually started filming before the stock market crashed, but you can tell it was tweaked as it went along, because the Depression kind of, there's a cloud over the movie that I think the Depression kind of fits. And, he has a lot to say in this movie about the class system in the US, even though this movie might not necessarily take place in, a U.S. town, which I don't know if he meant for it to be New York City, and he might have, but he has a lot to say about what was going on politically and economically in the country at the time. But he does it in such an entertaining way that you don't feel preached to, you don't feel like he's just sticking something in there. But it'd be pretty impossible at that time to not include what was going on. I think the Depression defined every piece of entertainment you saw.
Sure. And what's great is that his character is completely optimistic. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of his signature moves is to walk up to someone that he doesn't even know and just shake their hand in a hearty way. And he's surrounded by curmudgeons the rest of the movie, who probably sort of encapsulate the time and the attitude of the era. And it doesn't diminish the character's great spirit. And I think that in and of itself is sort of a political statement too, of where he thought people should be.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked about Chaplin, and I think he's the only one that we really need to delve deep into. We'll get to these other people. Let's just go into talking about the scenes, because I think that there's so many that we can dive into. So let's give ourselves a little extra time here. But to me, as you already mentioned the plot, but I just want to say everything is timed so perfectly, and the suspension of disbelief for the audience doesn't really have to happen as much, because he really plots everything so well. And the whole movie hinges on the scene from his first meeting with the blind girl and her believing that he is this millionaire. And it's all because of a very well-placed car door slam. And because, he walks through a car and she thinks he's getting out of a limo or whatever, or a really fancy Rolls Royce. And mm-hmm. she believes he's this millionaire throughout the whole movie. And it's placed so perfectly, and it's timed so well. And that whole scene of their first meeting is just great because it's very sweet. And then he'll punctuate it with something great. Like when she's going to the, he's sitting there just smitten and in love, and she's going there to the spigot to refill her water bucket, and she just throws it at him.
Yeah.
it's so great. And like I said, it perfectly punctuates, poignancy with humor.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what I love about that scene is the reason that he's going through that car door is he entered the car from the other side because he's running from the police. And so she thinks he's this millionaire character, and he's sort of, you know, he's this sort of reprobate who's going to be, he's going to be taken in if he's caught. He's a vagrant, basically. Mm-hmm. But then I love too that he's immediately smitten with this character, but he's not sleazy about it. And, no. You know, he goes and sits 20 feet away, and it's not, and he just sits kind of sweetly, and he's just wanting to see what her next move is. And it backfires on him. But yeah, it's a very sweet scene. You can tell that, and I think in my research, the love story of this was written first. Uh-huh. You know, that scene and sort of the ending scene, I think, were some of the ones that they had tried to shoot initially first. And he knew that's the story here, is the story of this character trying to win over the flower seller.
Yeah, there's nothing sleazy about it. It could have been in another director's hands. It could have seemed very, very just out of place and not a relationship you would root for. But he is so childlike, and yeah, you can tell his love is so pure for her that you're not offended. You're rooting for it the whole time. And to give credit to Virginia Cheryl, who plays the blind woman in this movie, had never acted before and was just kind of plucked out because she looked the part, and she could do kind of a nice glassy eyed look very well. Mm-hmm. Apparently she and Chaplin were not that fond of each other by the end of filming, because he was apparently pretty hard on her, but he got a very, very solid performance out of her, and she's very convincing as well. You know, a lot of times when someone plays blind in a movie, it's very overdone, but it's very natural.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think she does a good job. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, he fired her at one point.
He fired everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of amazing when you look at like 1915, he had like 8 or 12 films come out that year, just a ridiculous number of films. Mm-hmm. This one took 2 years to put together because they sort of started and stopped. And he was a perfectionist on this one and was very meticulous. The scenes that they kept work really well, though. I think there's some chemistry there between the two lead characters.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned it before, but also the opening scene at the dedication of the statue, it's one of the most dramatic reveals, I think, of his character in any movie, because they unveil the statue, and there he is laying in the arms of one of the peace and prosperity statues. And there's a lot of little jabs at the movie industry and that, and a lot of jabs at political things that were going on at the time. I love, because there's a wonderful moment where, you know, he's looking up close at somebody's hands, and it looks like he's thumbing his nose.
Oh, yeah.
it's totally on purpose, and it's brilliantly done. And also, you know, the very beginning of the movie, you have you know, the people who are dedicating the statue, and, you know, it sounds like an early version of like Charlie Brown's Teacher when they're talking, and it's his jab at, you know, there's no need for dialogue in movies. And it's also jabbing at, you know, the pomposity of, you know, these capitalist cities as well.
Sure.
So there's double meaning to a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah. And let's just take that piece there, because when you say it sounds like early Charlie Brown, it's Charlie Chaplin using a kazoo to make the sound of the whoever the presenter is, whatever that potentate is, whether it's a mayor or the city council member or whatever. Mm-hmm. He is saying, it does not matter what this person is saying. This person is a blowhard. And when you hear the words that they're saying, it all sounds the same. It sounds like it's coming through a kazoo. And it's definitely a deliberate choice. And I love too, then that there's a woman who's yelling too, and then he just changes the pitch of the kazoo, and it's just a different blowhard and a different pitch. So yeah, I really love how they, you know, you mentioned it. This isn't a true silent film because he uses sound, and it's right there at the beginning of this movie where he's using a kazoo to substitute as the voices of these individuals. And then just the movement around the statue as he's trying to climb out of it is perfectly choreographed. Yeah, and not only does he have the, it's a series of sort of still lifes or portraits that he paints visually as he moves in between them. And there's, you know, a time where he's sitting on the statue's hand and, you know, slid down the sword of the statue and can't get off of it. It's all really, really, it's funny. It's laugh out loud, funny slapstick stuff. And it morphs into these series of tableaus that have sort of this double entendre to them though. And it's really clever, really well done.
One of my favorite moments in that opening scene is when they're watching him trying to maneuver himself down, and all of a sudden the Star Spangled Banner plays and everybody halts to stand up.
Yeah. Yeah, just great comedic timing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So let's just move on to a couple others. What's one of your favorite scenes or comedic bits that happened in the movie?
So when we've got our tramp character with the millionaire, there's a couple of great scenes where they're together. The first one is where they go out on the town. So they go to some hot nightclub where both of them are intoxicated. I think they've been drinking at the millionaire's house previously. And they go out there, and Chaplin plays a very good drunk too. I mean, he's really hilarious. But there's a whole bit where the millionaire gives him a cigar, and he's trying to light it, and the cigars end up in each other's mouths, and a cigar ends up underneath a woman at the next table, and it's just hilarious stuff. But before you even get there, when they're introducing the scene, they go walking in, and you know that this character is completely out of place, because the minute his feet hit the dance floor, which would have been like a waxed smooth surface, he's stumbling all over the place. And it's just Charlie Chaplin's amazing physicality, and he's got to be helped by his friend and the maitre d' to the table. And it's just, it's a laugh out loud scene.
I love when he's trying to eat, and all of a sudden he gets the piece of confetti in his mouth, and he thinks it's like a piece of pasta, and he's trying to get it, and he's determined to get it as well. It's so beautifully done. The millionaire, I want to give credit to him. First of all, his name is Harry Myers, and he really kind of plays double parts in this, because even though he's playing the same character, the conceit is he only recognizes the tramp when he's drunk. Mm-hmm. And then when he's sober, he is a blowhard who wants nothing to do with him. And, you know, it's a great funny conceit of the movie. And of course, their first meeting, it could have been a very dark scene, because the millionaire, his wife has left him. He's very lonely, and he's committing suicide. He's tying a rope around him with a brick, and he's going to throw himself in the river. And, you know, and the tramp, being ever the optimist, is trying to talk him out of it and saying, you know, the birds are going to sing tomorrow, and mm-hmm. all of that kind of stuff. And, and of course, him being drunk, he doesn't quite have the coordination. So he accidentally throws it around the tramp and throws it into the river. And it's great moments of, you know, them both falling in, them coming out. Yeah. It's a wonderfully, wonderfully done scene.
Yeah, no, it really is. And again, that was the second actor to play the millionaire, because the first one didn't want to go in the water. And yeah. It was what a hilarious scene though, that they both end up in there. I mean, mm-hmm. the millionaire's trying to get in there, accidentally puts the tramp in, tries to help the tramp in, then he goes in, and it's just it's really a well done scene there too.
And that that river, supposedly, that was like the pool at United Artists at the studio at the time, at Chaplin's own studio. And most of this movie was shot on a back lot or in a studio. I think the only like real outdoor location shot is the early morning when the millionaire and the tramp are driving drunk home. And those are the actual streets of Los Angeles at like 6 a.m. or something when no one was on the road.
But, which is good because they're on the sidewalk for half of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see. And another one of my favorites, I love when he is at one of the millionaire's sort of roaring 20s speakeasy parties and he accidentally swallows a whistle, and some great, great stuff with that. And again, another reason why this isn't a true silent movie, because you know, someone's trying to sing and, you know, he's interrupting with that. And finally he goes outside and there's two really great bits. There's one where a cab pulls over thinking he's trying to hail a cab.
Yeah. And then he waves the cab off and the cabbie is completely upset. Yeah.
And then of course, being, you know, so high pitched, you know, dogs come around and attack him and they follow him inside and could totally disrupt the party.
Yeah. I love that. So he's outside. And it's a bit we've seen before.
This
might have been the first time it was done.
Possibly.
But he's got a whistle and accidentally swallows it. And every time he hiccups, the whistle goes off. So this is a Warner Brothers cartoon. You know, we've seen it there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he goes outside and the cab goes on. And then I love that, like, he does a whistle, two dogs show up. And then I'm like, oh, that's great. That's funny. I wasn't expecting. He goes back into the house. Now there's like six dogs chasing him and he just sits down on the couch and all the dogs just jump on him. And it's a really funny bit. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what's another great one for you?
So probably the most intricate scene of the movie in my mind, cause there are a series of bits, mm-hmm. throughout this movie. And by the way, none of them feel shoehorned in. They all feel like they were really well thought out with how the movie goes. But start to finish, when he decides to go earn a few bucks by taking up boxing, mm-hmm. The whole thing is hilarious. So immediately when he goes in there and he's got the gloves on and they're upside down, I mean, it's just, it's a funny visual, and you get immediately the impression that the tramp has no idea what he's doing in there. And so they go through a couple of things in the locker room, including trying to get some good luck. So he's talking to one of the other boxers who has a rabbit's foot that he sort of rubs on his face. And so then Chaplin's character rubs the rabbit's foot on his face. And then the other boxer goes in for his match, and it's quickly over, and they bring that boxer back in who's completely unconscious, and Chaplin picks up a towel and tries to wipe the rabbit's foot juju or whatever it is off of his face. And then eventually he gets into the ring. And that is just an amazing sequence. It's a dance. I mean, and what's amazing about it too is they lull you into believing here's how the dance is going to go. And then they switch it on you and they do this whole sequence, people getting knocked out, picked back up, hiding behind the referee with zero cuts. It's an amazing physical sequence. And it's a good, I don't know, it's probably a 7-minute scene.
Oh yeah. It's intricate choreography. It is a dance, like you mentioned, and it's got everything in the kitchen sink, because I love the bit where, you know, he keeps ringing the bell and, you know, he ends the round, he starts the round. And then there's a wonderful moment where he kind of flies at his opponent. And you can totally see the string pulling, but you don't care. Right. And it's totally good. And the actor playing the other boxer and the actor playing the ref are just as impressive as he is, because they're doing it too.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Yeah, it's totally great. And I love the locker room scene, as you meant at the beginning. I love, once the fighter that he's supposed to fight ends up leaving, and he tries to, you know, do the same thing with this other guy 50-50, and he's almost trying to sweet talk him, like he's flirting with him almost, and it's so great. And all of these guys apparently were real boxers that he's using here, and some of those guys are really meaty guys, and you can tell that they were. They're playing right along, and yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah. No, and to me, that whole sequence is the reason to go see this movie. I mean, if you want to see physical comedy done at its apex, that's the scene to check out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, there's other wonderful little bits. I love where he stayed the night with the millionaire, and you know, they find him the next morning and he's asleep in the bed, and they're trying to rush him out, and they, you know, they pull his clothes off, and he, you know, he keeps running out. And then of course he and the butler have this great little chemistry in all these little scenes. And you know, and they're in the final encounter where the millionaire finally gives him the money to give the operation for the blind woman, even though he's drunk and doesn't really know what he's doing. You know, the police come in to get him, and I love the bit with the gun where he's able to get the gun, and then finally he gives it back to the officer. And right. There's so many wonderful things, and there's almost, you almost have to watch this movie several times because there's so many different things going on and all of these different scenes that you can't keep up.
Yeah. And one of the other funny just visual scenes for me is he takes this job, he's going straight, he's a street sweeper. And you can see him, and I love that this is pre-code, so you don't have to worry too much about that, but they don't want to be crass, so they don't show what he's sweeping up. But this is late 20s, early 30s. There's definitely automobiles around, but you know there are horses too. So he's definitely cleaning up horse manure that has gone into the sort of the gutter along the side of the street. So he does a little pickup of that, and then he walks to the intersection of the street, and you just see dozens of horses crossing in front of the camera, and you just see the tramp's shoulders kind of slump down, like, I know I've got to clean up after all of these horses. And you think, okay, that's hilarious. And then out of nowhere, an elephant comes walking by, and it's just completely out of the blue, completely unexpected, but just shows you how down on his luck this guy is, that sure enough, there's an elephant walking through the city.
Yeah, and you, good point. You mentioned this being pre-code, and for our listeners, we've mentioned it before, but the pre-code in 1934, the Breen office, which was the censorship office, created the Hays Code in Hollywood, which set up a series of standards and rules that Hollywood films had to abide by. And it was mainly, you know, taking any kind of, you know, vulgarity, sexual innuendo, anything out of movies. Well, that started in 1934. So if you look at movies made before 1934, there's some very, still nothing like you would necessarily see today, but very suggestive things in those movies. And you know, this is a pre-code movie, and there are a couple of scenes, like I'm thinking about early on when he's window shopping, and there's the nude statue of the woman that he's totally ogling. And I don't know if you would get a scene like that past, you know, 1934, but and then there's another little bit with the sidewalk shaft, you know. Yes. where he keeps walking on, and that had to be so rehearsed. And you mentioned this movie's available on streaming, but there is a beautiful Blu-ray that the Criterion Collection brought out a few years ago, which I have. And there's actual rehearsal footage of Chaplin rehearsing that scene as a special edition. And it's funny, it's Chaplin out of his tramp garb. So it's a very tall, very elegant looking, tanned Charlie Chaplin doing this. And he's, and of course it's silent, you can't hear anything, but it's him working out with the guy who's operating it, you know, exactly when to do it and when to walk back and how many count. It's fascinating to watch, but you can imagine just the amount of patience it took to work up these bits.
Yeah. And I think that goes underappreciated today. When in the silent film era, you had to rely on visuals. But, you know, one of the movies that we talked about not too long ago, The Great Race, sort of went back to that. And if you look at these two movies sort of side by side, kind of like we did, you can see that The Great Race is an homage to all of these great slapstick movies that intricately planned out these comedy bits that you just couldn't have seen a sound for. So these scenes had to stand on their own, and they're amazing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And now that we've started talking about, you know, Chaplin, I hope that we can get to other great silent comedians, people like Buster Keaton and Harold yes. Lloyd and Laurel and Hardy, because they inspired so many people. Because, you know, we have talked on the show about Abbott and Costello and the Marx Brothers, and you know while they're much more verbal comedians, a lot of their slapstick stuff was taken entirely from Chaplin and Keaton, and everything is a descendant of what, you know, Chaplin did. And Chaplin was doing his tramp character in English music halls in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So yeah. this is something he had tried out on audiences, you know, for years. So, you know, but by the time we get to 1931, he's a master of his craft and at what he did.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned Lou Costello, because when we talked about them at Monster Cast with Abbott and Costello, I mean, all the monsters, Frankenstein, but it was all the monsters.
Yeah.
That is a great example of Lou Costello doing his, you know, I'm a bad little boy bit. Mm-hmm. It's Chaplin. I mean, he's channeling that sweetness that this tramp character has. And you mentioned it in the boxing locker room. That could have been Lou Costello doing the same sort of dove eyes and the demure look at the boxer. So, and it's hard to think that those movies are, you know, 20 some years apart too. You know, it took that long for Lou Costello. He's that far removed from Charlie Chaplin. Charlie Chaplin was doing it that much earlier. And we should point out, too, he had a 75-year career in the movies. So it's kind of a shame that it's taken us this long to get around to him, because he's that influential.
Mm-hmm. Let's, before we move on, let's talk about the final scene. And I think it's the reason why this movie is so highly regarded. Final scene really doesn't have a whole lot of comedy in it.
No.
But it's one of the most pure, poignant scenes I think you'll find in any movie. And it's a payoff for, you know, everything that we've been waiting for. As you mentioned, you know, he's infatuated with this blind flower girl. He has done all these odd jobs trying to make money. He finally cons the millionaire to give him the money. And before he gets arrested for what they perceived as him stealing money, he gets the money to this flower girl, and he's in jail, you know, for months. You know, we don't know exactly how long, but months. And he comes out and he's all, you know, unkempt, and, you know, what's left of his little tuxedo that he wears is fine.
Yeah.
Now. And we know before he does that the flower girl has had a successful operation and has her sight. And, you know, every time somebody walks into the store, into the flower shop, you know, she's just imagining that it's him. And, you know, and we see a scene where a very, you know, elegant looking millionaire type walks in, and she thinks it might be him, and, you know, it's not. And, you know, slowly, you know, he walks up to the window, and he's there's a bit in the beginning of him fighting with these, you know, juvenile delinquent kind of newsboys on the side of the street, and he's doing that again, and she sees it, and she's amused by him, and she's even kind of mocking him. I believe, yeah, the critic was James Agee, who said, and Chaplin, what might be one of the purest forms of screen acting in the history of movies, when he finally realizes it's her and he looks in the window, he does this 90-degree turn. And the look on his face is, you know, it says so much. And you're right, it does what dialogue could never do. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, she doesn't know what's going on, and, you know, she thinks he wants to buy something, and she goes out to talk to him, and finally he grabs her hand and she feels his hand, and but at that time, because she recognizes his touch, she knows it's him. And it's a beautiful, beautiful scene.
The beauty in it to me is sort of the subtlety of it.
Yeah.
He doesn't overact it.
No.
In fact, he pulls way back. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have this character who's got this kinetic energy all throughout the film and is sort of an oddball, and now he's just he's a shy, smitten individual, and it just comes across. He doesn't have to say a word, and in fact, the only thing that he says, and I think there is a card for it, but he asks her if she can see, and it's not, hey, it's me. Hey, I love you. He's concerned about her. Mm-hmm. And it just informs so much about that character. And it's beautiful. It's a real great button for the end of this movie.
Yeah. And I love that it ends there. It doesn't, you know, tell you what becomes of the two of them. It just ends there because that's the moment that we've been waiting for. It doesn't matter what happens after that. The point is that they found each other, you know, that she can see, and that, you know, he's sort of regained his optimism and hope that he kind of, because the moment that we see him kind of lose his hope and optimism is when he gets put in jail. And then finally, you know, it gets restored again at the end.
Yeah. So, yeah. Brayden, I had a question for you about this too. Mm-hmm. And it's about the title of this movie. So what do you think City Lights actually means? And why is this chosen as the title of this movie when previous movies are, you know,
The Circus, yeah,
the circus, The Pilgrim, it, or whatever they are, they're very descriptive about a certain character, and you kind of have an idea. This one's different.
Yeah, I think it could be an over-encompassing title, you know, where you know, there are a million stories that happen underneath these city lights, and that, you know, you know, there's sort of there's a facade to a city, and yet there's so many issues going on underneath the glitz and the glamour that you would see when you look at it just, you know, at face value. You know, the there's so much, there's so many stories, you know, that aren't necessarily being told, and, you know, and all that. You know, I know it's a title that's been debated forever. I don't know if anybody ever got a definitive answer. What was your take?
Yeah, and I don't have a definitive answer. You know, my personal opinion is that some of the themes of this movie are sort of the differences between what you really see and what you don't. And so, you know, we've got a main character who's sightless, who gains sight, and it's almost like the light's coming on for her. We've also got this millionaire character who's very different during the day, but when the lights of the city come on, he's, you know, he's a drunk and completely depressed, and has this best friend that he doesn't remember in the daylight. So I think there are a lot of themes that run through it. But I think it was also Chaplin sort of, you mentioned it, he was starting to get political, and he wanted to shine a light on what the city life was actually like for a lot of people. Yeah. And that was his character. You know, there's a lot of people that lived just like that character.
Oh yeah.
So it's a more poignant movie than you probably would initially think.
Absolutely. And all three of these main characters, and I'll include the millionaire in it, they're all kind of outcasts of society in their own way.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're right. And it's maybe, you know, with, you know, they're the kind of people that he felt should have been paid more attention to that necessarily weren't. And it doesn't have to necessarily be from a certain class. It can be from both classes.
Yeah.
And I think that he defines that brilliantly. Before we move on kind of to the legacy and other, a couple other things I want to ask you, is there anything at all that didn't work for you in this?
You know, not really.
Yeah.
And this is, it's hard to say that top to bottom, this movie works almost in every part. It's real tight. It's an 87 minute movie. So it really moves along at a good clip. I guess if you're a movie fanatic and a movie buff, silent may not be your thing. You know, you do have to pay attention to the screen. You know, I do know other people who will watch a movie and they'll have a phone or a device on at the same time, and they'll just kind of get the movie by osmosis, and the dialogue sort of tells them what's going on. Mm-hmm. Can't do that with this one.
Right.
But that's not saying that doesn't work. It's just, heads up, listeners, you got to pay attention to this one.
Yeah. And I do want to talk about like the overarching idea of silent movies when we close here. But yeah, I think you're right. There's such an economy of storytelling in this that it flies by. I mean, it's less than an hour and a half, so it flies by and you can easily watch it in one sitting, you know, but you do have to be paying attention. As we sort of get to the final categories here, it's pretty interesting that even though we were, you know, dead in the middle of the advent of sound movies, this movie was a blockbuster. It only cost, I think, a little over $1 million to make, and ended up making $5 million. It made $2 million here in the U.S. and $3 million internationally, because mm-hmm. Chaplin was huge internationally too. And it did all right in its premiere, but then word of mouth spread. And like we said, there were luminaries of the premiere, you know. I think Chaplin sat in between Albert Einstein and Lady Astor. Wow. at the premiere. Yeah, so it pretty remarkable. The interesting thing is, I believe, and let me check, I think, yeah, no Oscar nominations for this movie. And it wasn't a surprise, because I think the Academy was really wanting to honor what they felt was the future, sound films. And Chaplin was kind of an outsider. He didn't campaign. He didn't send out letters. He didn't do any four-year consideration ads in the paper. And in 1929, they gave him a special Oscar for special achievement for, I forget what, I think it was The Circus for that movie, but you know, he didn't campaign for this movie, and I don't think there was any way that the Academy was going to honor it. But they didn't need to. I mean, it was a huge hit. The Academy did, and I sent you a video earlier this week. I don't know if you got a chance to watch it, but the Academy finally did give Chaplin his due. In 1972, Chaplin sort of went on a self-imposed exile out of the U.S. and didn't return for decades. And then he finally did in the early 70s, because the Academy wanted to honor him. And it was I believe it still holds the record, the longest ovation for anybody in Oscar history. I believe the ovation went on for 12 minutes. If you watch, wow, you know, clips of it, they edit it down. But I believe people stood and cheered for him for 12 minutes. And his speech is very short, and you can tell he's incredibly moved by it. And, you know, I think it was Hollywood's one chance to let him know, you know, you might not have always been treated well by the men who ran this town, but your peers certainly know what the genius you are.
That's a long time. 1972.
Yeah.
I mean, to go from the silent era to the 70s just kind of blows your mind mm-hmm. to hear that.
And that
all being yeah. said, his self-imposed exile was also related to some of the personal stuff that he had going yeah. on with, you know, he had a lot of relationship issues. And I think maybe we'll just leave it at that. And yeah, he probably wasn't.
And unpopular political beliefs, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So he very much fell out of favor mm-hmm. With Hollywood. They should recognize it. They should have recognized him a lot earlier for the contributions to filmmaking. Mm-hmm.
But that that clip is on YouTube, and I encourage anybody to go and watch it, because it's pretty remarkable to see, you know, Chaplin, who was in his 70s, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful little moment where someone tosses him a hat and a cane, and he puts it on, you know, pretty quickly and takes it out. Yeah.
What's amazing is he's unrecognizable.
Yeah.
When he's not in that get up, it's like, who is this guy? And you mentioned it, that he's sort of a
very elegant looking man. Yeah.
Yeah. And spoke with a British accent, you mm-hmm. know, that I'm not sure that people know that he's, you know, he wasn't an American. Mm-hmm. He was born in England. So.
Yeah. But as we mentioned, you know, City Lights really, really grew in favor. It was added to the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress in 1991. In 1998, this is interesting. In 98, when the American Film Institute did their first list, it was number 76. But then for the 10th anniversary in 2007, it shot all the way up from 76 to number 11.
Wow.
And I'm wondering if it was a movie people hadn't watched in a while, and then because it was on the list, people went back and watched it. And it suddenly, you know, went up in higher esteem, because I think the Gold Rush of Modern Times ranked even higher than that did on the initial list. And then it just shot up, you know, to almost cracking the top 10. And then on the other list, let me see, it ranked number 38 on the funniest movies of all time, number 10 on the greatest love stories of all time, number 33 on the most inspirational movies of all time. And this is interesting, the number one romantic comedy of all time.
That is kind of interesting, because it doesn't jump out at you as a romantic comedy, but it certainly is. It certainly is.
Yeah, it's not what people think of in terms of like rom-com, but certainly, but it does fill the bill. It is a romantic comedy. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful film. Go ahead.
There are some lists that this is number one in the greatest movie. Orson Welles had said this is what he thought was the best movie ever made. So,
and it was one of Francois Truffaut's favorite movies. It's one of Martin Scorsese's favorite movies. You can name any kind of major filmmaker. Billy Wilder, it was one of his favorites.
Yeah.
And so, the inspiration just flows down. Before we get to our final thoughts on the movie, Eric, I told you I was going to ask you this a little bit earlier, but if somebody, I think the hardest sell for somebody, even for cinephiles, you know, it's hard enough to convince someone to watch maybe an old movie. It's hard enough to convince someone to watch a black and white movie. What would you say to someone who might be hesitant to watch a silent movie?
That is an excellent question that I hadn't considered. And it's a blind spot for me. Mm-hmm. You know, we do a classics podcast, and I don't know that this is one of a handful of silent movies that I've seen. Mm-hmm. So to break this apart a little bit, we mentioned it before. This isn't what you probably think of as a silent movie. It's not a melodrama with title cards. This is an excellent piece of filmmaking. To break that apart a little further, though, too, movies at their core are storytelling. So why go seek out a silent movie? Because every piece of cinema that came after it came from these, and the art of telling a visual story through time, you know, obviously before this, all the way back to cave paintings, we had static images of that were considered art. So when movies came around, even in the silent era, they were the very first thing that you could do that said, I could tell this story, and now I can tell it over a period of time and have it move. These movies did some amazing things, and it's a different skill set. You have to be able to stage a photograph and tell a story in a much different way in a silent picture. This is sort of the pinnacle of that, you know, where everything is staged and timed perfectly that you don't even need the half a dozen title cards that were in this movie.
It's the purest form of storytelling, because I think a lot of time dialogue is what dates a movie, certain references. In silent movies, you don't have that. And silent, you know, pantomime, slapstick is eternal because it's universal. And I would suggest if someone wants to get into silent movies, try these comedies first. The dramas are going to be a little bit more of a slog to get through, just because there's a lot more, you know, a lot more trying to figure out what's going on in terms of like the title cards and everything. But these early master comedians, the Chaplins, the Keatons, the Lloyds, their work is universal and it's eternal and it just goes on. And what was funny in, you know, what was funny in 1931 is going to be funny in 2031. Mm-hmm. And you're going to understand it, I think, just as well as audiences did back then. So I think any Chaplin movie, but this I think would be a great gateway into someone wanting to understand what silent movies were all about.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, I think this is where you start. So I'm glad this is where we started.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So final thoughts on City Lights.
Yeah, so my first time seeing this movie, it was way more enjoyable than I would have thought. I was looking forward to it. So my expectations were high. What I didn't know was the sweetness, especially in a silent movie, that it would have such a romantic feel to it, and that you would be rooting for this character that you never hear say a word. So for me, this was a big hole in my cinema background. I'm really glad to have filled that in. And I would recommend it to anybody. If you love movies, this is one of the reasons you love movies. Go watch this one.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's the best. Like I said, I think if you were to ask me, you know, to pick a movie to watch, I think Modern Times might be the one I go toward, but I think this encompasses Chaplin the best. I think it is a beautiful story, and it can tug at your heartstrings. I mean, even, you know, like I said, 90 years later, I mean, in 10 years, this movie is going to be a century old, and it's pretty remarkable that you are watching and identifying with people that lived generations before you.
Yeah.
And I think that is why that's the miracle of the movies, is that you can watch and identify with people. You know, you might think life was completely different, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
I think this is one of the best examples of that. It'll make you laugh. And like I said, some of the most brilliant bits of comedic choreography you'll ever see. So yeah, give it a chance. And it's a remarkable piece of work. And I'm glad we finally tackled a silent movie. And mm-hmm. I'm glad this was the first one. We, since our last episode that we did, The Sound of Music, which, by the way, I bragged earlier about how wonderful Annie Mame was. Well, Sound of Music blew Annie Mame out of the water. That's one of our most downloaded episodes by far. And I think I was suspecting that. but we have, I think, between the last time we recorded that and this, Eric and I sat down and plotted out our whole year. And if you thought 2020 was a big year for us, 2021, I think we are tackling every single conceivable type of genre coming
on
up.
On purpose.
And I was going through the list of the kinds of directors that we're going to talk about and actors. We just tackled a silent movie. We're going to tackle foreign films later on. We're going to tackle other silent movies. We're going to tackle every kind of genre, from westerns, musicals, sci-fi, horror, you know, straight drama, you know, and everything in between. So, and actually, next month we're going to tackle a more kind of modern example of romantic comedy, and we're going to talk about someone we haven't talked about yet either. We're going to talk about Woody Allen, and there's a little bit of baggage to Woody Allen to talk about, but
to say the least.
But we'll discuss it. Our friend Aaron McCabe is going to join us, and we're going to talk about Annie Hall, which is probably his best known film from 1977. It's a Best Picture winner, and I'm interested. It's been a while since I've watched it. I'm interested to see how well it holds up.
Yeah, I probably watched this movie 2 or 3 years ago, so very much post the news and what we now know about Woody Allen. And it put a different slant on it. So looking forward to speaking about it.
Yeah, it'll be, and it's also interesting because we talked a lot about Diane Keaton last year, but in her role as Kay in The Godfather. And so now to talk about, I think probably the way that most people know her is a comedic actress. So that'll be fun to talk about. And then also we'll talk about another comedy in February. Brett Rutherford and Vanessa Ferguson are going to join us for His Girl Friday. And so that'll be fun to talk about a screwball comedy. So a lot of stuff coming up, and we're going to have polls. I think in February, we're going to have a poll coming up in April, but I want to get it out so that we can get the vote out, and then you and I can plan to actually discuss the film, but we'll have a Best Picture winner poll coming out and in April, and just in time for Oscars, we'll have another film noir poll, and so just a lot of good stuff coming up. So keep an eye on our Facebook page. Find us at FRN Classics Pod on Instagram, and if you have any suggestions for us, if you like what we do, if you don't like what we do, email us at classicsfrn@gmail.com. I've said it wrong before, but I want to make sure I say it right this time. classicsfrn@gmail.com. We've had a couple people email us, and His Girl Friday is a request from one of our listeners. So if you request a movie, we will put it on our schedule. And
so is The Sound of Music too. So
yeah, Sound of Music. Kelly, who was on the episode with us, wanted to talk about it. So yeah, we will find time on the schedule to do that. So plenty of content coming up. Eric, anything else you want to say about the coming year? I mean, we got a ton of stuff.
Yeah. Just keep the communications coming to us. We really appreciate the feedback. It lets us know what our listeners want to hear. Looking forward to discussing His Girl Friday at the request of one of our listeners.
Yeah. So just keep listening, keep watching, and we will be back with even more content. We've also got a great slate of guest co-hosts this year. I'm really excited to talk with a wonderful variety of people. So we can look forward to that as well. So as we wrap up this episode and we close out January, for the Front Row, I am Brandon Davis.
And I'm Eric Flick.
And we will see you in the Front Row.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to this episode, a proud member of the Front Row Network of shows on NPR Illinois. For the past 5 years, we've been providing hours of content every month, and now we've created the chance for all of you to get even more content. We've officially launched our Patreon page to give you the chance to support our work. There are 4 separate levels, and each come with their own amazing bonus perks, including exclusive episodes, full movie commentary tracks, and even the ability to choose what episodes we do and be on them with us. To show your support, simply go to www.patreon.com/frontrownetwork. That's patreon.com/frontrownetwork. Thank you again, and as always, we'll see you in the Front Row.